could be undone by the smallest of snags. Yesterday the entire illusion had been shattered by a few bioluminescent plankton. From the cockpit of the idling Kiowa, Delta One watched the drama unfold before him. Rachel and Tolland appeared to be in complete control, although Delta One almost had to laugh at the hollowness of the illusion. The machine gun in Tolland's hands was worthless. Even from here, Delta One could see the cocking bar assembly had kicked back, indicating the clip was empty. As Delta One gazed out at his partner struggling in the Triton's claws, he knew he had to hurry. The focus on deck had turned completely to Pickering, and now Delta One could make his move. Leaving the rotors idling, he slipped out of the rear of the fuselage and, using the chopper for cover, made his way unseen onto the starboard gangway. With his own machine gun in hand, he headed for the bow. Pickering had given him specific orders before they landed on deck, and Delta One had no intention of failing at this simple task. In a matter of minutes, he knew, this will all be over. Chapter 122. Still wearing his bathrobe, Zack Herney sat at his desk in the Oval Office, his head throbbing. The newest piece of the puzzle had just been revealed. Marjorie Tench is dead. Herney's aide said they had information suggesting Tench had driven to the FDR Memorial for a private meeting with William Pickering. Now that Pickering was missing, the staff feared Pickering, too, might be dead. The president and Pickering had endured their battles lately. Months ago, Herney learned that Pickering had engaged in illegal activity on Herney's behalf in an attempt to save Herney's floundering campaign. Employing NRO assets, Pickering had discreetly obtained enough dirt on Senator Sexton to sink his campaign. Scandalous sexual photos of the senator with his aide, Gabrielle Ash. Incriminating financial records, proving Sexton was taking bribes from private space companies. Pickering anonymously sent all the evidence to Marjorie Tench, assuming the White House would use it wisely. But Herney, upon seeing the data, had forbidden Tench to use it. Sex scandals and bribery were cancers in Washington, and waving another one in front of the public only added to their distrust of government. Cynicism is killing this country. Although Herney knew he could destroy Sexton with scandal, the cost would be besmirching the dignity of the U.S. Senate, something Herney refused to do. No more negatives. Herney would beat Senator Sexton on the issues. Pickering, angered by the White House's refusal to use the evidence he had provided, tried to jump-start the scandal by leaking a rumor that Sexton had slept with Gabrielle Ash. Unfortunately, Sexton declared his innocence with such convincing indignation that the president ended up having to apologize for the leak personally. In the end, William Pickering had done more damage than good. Herney told Pickering that if he ever interfered in the campaign again, he would be indicted. The grand irony, of course, was that Pickering did not even like President Herney. The NRO director's attempts to help Herney's campaign were simply fears over the fate of NASA. Zack Herney was the lesser of two evils. Now has someone killed Pickering? Herney couldn't imagine. "Mr. President," an aide said, "as you requested, I called Lawrence Dextrom and told him about Marjorie Tench." "Thank you. He would like to speak to you, sir." Herney was still furious with Dextrom for lying about pods. "Tell him I'll talk to him in the morning." "Mr. Dextrom wants to talk to you right away, sir." The aide looked uneasy. "He's very upset." "He's upset?" Herney could feel his temper fraying around the edges. As he stalked off to take Ekstrom's call, the president wondered what the hell else could possibly go wrong tonight. Chapter 123. On board the Goya, Rachel felt lightheaded. The mystification that had settled around her like a heavy fog was lifting now. The stark reality that came into focus left her feeling naked and disgusted. She looked at the stranger before her and could barely hear his voice. "We needed to rebuild NASA's image," Pickering was saying. "Their declining popularity and funding had become dangerous on so many levels." Pickering paused, his gray eyes locking on hers. "Rachel, NASA was desperate for a triumph. Someone had to make it happen." Something had to be done, Pickering thought. The meteorite had been a final act of desperation. Pickering and others had tried to save NASA by lobbying to incorporate the space agency into the intelligence community where it would enjoy increased funding and better security. But the White House continuously rebuffed the idea as an assault on pure science. Short-sighted idealism. With the rising popularity of Sexton's anti-NASA rhetoric, Pickering and his band of military power brokers knew time was running short. They decided that capturing the imagination of taxpayers and Congress was the only remaining way to salvage NASA's image and save it from the auction block. If the space agency was to survive, it would need an infusion of grandeur, something to remind the taxpayers of NASA's Apollo glory days. And if Zach Herney was going to defeat Senator Sexton, he was going to need help. "I tried to help him," Pickering told himself, recalling all the damaging evidence he had sent to Marjorie Tench. Unfortunately, Herney had forbidden its use, leaving Pickering no choice but to take drastic measures. "Rachel," Pickering said, "the information you just faxed off this ship is dangerous. You must understand that. If it gets out, the White House and NASA will look complicit. The backlash against the President and NASA will be enormous. The President and NASA know nothing, Rachel. They are innocent. They believe the meteorite is authentic." Pickering hadn't even tried to bring Herney or Ekstrom into the fold, because both were far too idealistic to have agreed to any deceit, regardless of its potential to save the presidency or space agency. Administrator Ekstrom's only crime had been persuading the pod's mission supervisor to lie about the anomaly software, a move Ekstrom no doubt regretted the moment he realized how scrutinized this particular meteorite would become. Marjorie Tench, frustrated by Herney's insistence on fighting a clean campaign, conspired with Ekstrom on the pod's lie, hoping a small pod success might help the president fend off the rising Sexton tide. "If Tench had used the photos and bribery data I gave her, none of this would have happened." Tench's murder, though deeply regrettable, had been destined as soon as Rachel called Tench and made accusations of fraud. Pickering knew Tench would investigate ruthlessly until she got to the bottom of Rachel's motives for the outrageous claims, and this was one investigation Pickering obviously could never let happen. Ironically, Tench would serve her president best in death, her violent end helping cement a sympathy vote for the White House, as well as cast vague suspicions of foul play on a desperate Sexton campaign, which had been so publicly humiliated by Marjorie Tench on CNN. Rachel stood her ground, glaring at her boss. "Understand," Pickering said, "if news of this meteorite fraud gets out, you will destroy an innocent president and an innocent space agency. You will also put a very dangerous man in the Oval Office. I need to know where you faxed the data." As he spoke those words, a strange look came across Rachel's face. It was the pained expression of horror of someone who had just realized they may have made a grave mistake. Having circled the bow and come back down the port side, Delta One now stood in the hydro lab from which he had seen Rachel emerge as the chopper had flown in. A computer in the lab displayed an unsettling image, a polychromatic rendering of the pulsating, deepwater vortex that was apparently hovering over the ocean floor somewhere beneath the Goya. "Another reason to get the hell out of here," he thought, moving now toward his target. The fax machine was on a counter on the far side of the wall. The tray was filled with a stack of papers exactly as Pickering had guessed it would be. Delta One picked up the stack. A note from Rachel was on top. Only two lines. He read it. To the point, he thought. As he flipped through the pages, he was both amazed and dismayed by the extent to which Tolland and Rachel had uncovered the meteorite deception. Whoever saw these printouts would have no doubt what they meant. Fortunately, Delta One would not even need to hit redial to find out where the printouts had gone. The last fax number was still displayed in the LCD window, a Washington, D.C. prefix. He carefully copied the fax number down, grabbed all the papers, and exited the lab. Tolland's hands felt sweaty on the machine gun as he gripped it, aiming the muzzle at William Pickering's chest. The NRO director was still pressuring Rachel to tell him where the data had been sent, and Tolland was starting to get the uneasy feeling that Pickering was simply trying to buy time. For what? "The White House and NASA are innocent," Pickering repeated. "Work with me. Don't let my mistakes destroy what little credibility NASA has left. NASA will look guilty if this gets out. You and I can come to an arrangement. The country needs this meteorite. Tell me where you faxed the data before it's too late."
"So you can kill someone else?" Rachel said. "You make me sick."
Tolland was amazed with Rachel's fortitude. She despised her father, but she clearly had no intention of putting the senator in any danger whatsoever. Unfortunately, Rachel's plan to fax her father for help had backfired. Even if the senator came into his office, saw the fax, and called the president with news of the meteorite fraud and told him to call off the attack, nobody at the White House would have any idea what Sexton was talking about, or even where they were. "I will only say this one more time," Pickering said, fixing Rachel with a menacing glare. "The situation is far too complex for you to fully understand. You've made an enormous mistake by sending that data off this ship. You've put your country at risk." William Pickering was indeed buying time, Tolland now realized, and the reason was striding calmly toward them up the starboard side of the boat. Tolland felt a flash of fear when he saw the soldiers sauntering toward them, carrying a stack of papers and a machine gun. Tolland reacted with a decisiveness that shocked even himself. Gripping the machine gun, he wheeled, aimed at the soldier, and pulled the trigger. The gun made an innocuous click. "I found the fax number," the soldier said, handing Pickering a slip of paper. "And Mr. Tolland is out of ammunition." Chapter 124. Sedgwick Sexton stormed up the hallway of the Philip A. Hart Senate office building. He had no idea how Gabrielle had done it, but she had obviously gotten into his office. While they were speaking on the phone, Sexton had clearly heard the distinctive triple click of his Jourdain clock in the background. All he could imagine was that Gabrielle's eavesdropping on the SFF meeting had undermined her trust in him, and she had gone digging for evidence. "How the hell did she get into my office?" Sexton was glad he'd changed his computer password. When he arrived at his private office, Sexton typed in his code to deactivate the alarm. Then he fumbled for his keys, unlocked the heavy doors, threw them open, and burst in, intent on catching Gabrielle in the act. But the office was empty and dark, lit only by the glow of his computer screensaver. He turned on the lights, his eyes scanning. Everything looked in place. Dead silence, except for the triple tick of his clock. "Where the hell is she?" He heard something rustle in his private bathroom and raced over, turning on the light. The bathroom was empty. He looked behind the door. Nothing. Puzzled, Sexton eyed himself in the mirror, wondering if he'd had too much to drink tonight. "I heard something." Feeling disoriented and confused, he walked back into his office. "Gabrielle?" he called out. He went down the hall to her office. She wasn't there. Her office was dark. A toilet flushed in the ladies' room, and Sexton spun, striding now back in the direction of the restrooms. He arrived just as Gabrielle was exiting, drying her hands. She jumped when she saw him.
"My God, you scared me," she said, looking genuinely frightened. "What are you doing here?"
"You said you were getting NASA documents from your office," he declared, eyeing her empty hands. "Where are they?"
"I couldn't find them. I looked everywhere. That's what took so long."
He stared directly into her eyes. "Were you in my office?"
"I owe my life to his fax machine," Gabrielle thought.
Only minutes ago, she'd been sitting at Sexton's computer trying to make printouts of the images of illegal checks on his computer. The files were protected somehow, and she was going to need more time to figure out how to print them. She would probably still be trying right now if Sexton's fax machine had not rung, startling her and snapping her back to reality. Gabrielle took it as her cue to get out. Without taking time to see what the incoming fax was, she logged off Sexton's computer, tidied up, and headed out the way she had come. She was just climbing out of Sexton's bathroom when she heard him coming in. Now, with Sexton standing before her, staring down, she sensed him searching her eyes for a lie. Sedgwick Sexton could smell untruths like nobody Gabrielle had ever met. If she lied to him, Sexton would know.
"You've been drinking,"
Gabrielle said, turning away. "How does he know I was in his office?" Sexton put his hands on her shoulders and spun her back around. "Were you in my office?" Gabrielle felt a rising fear. Sexton had indeed been drinking. His touch was rough.
"In your office?" she demanded, forcing a confused laugh.
"How? Why?" "I heard my Jourdain in the background when I called you." Gabrielle cringed inwardly.
His clock. It hadn't even occurred to her. "Do you know how ridiculous that sounds?"
"I spend all day in that office. I know what my clock sounds like." Gabrielle sensed she had to end this immediately. The best defense is a good offense. At least that's what Yolanda Cole always said. Placing her hands on her hips, Gabrielle went for him with all she had. She stepped toward him, getting in his face, glaring.
"Let me get this straight, Senator. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. You've been drinking. You heard a ticking on your phone, and that's why you're here?"
She pointed her finger indignantly down the hall at his door.
"Just for the record, are you accusing me of disarming a federal alarm system, picking 2 sets of locks, breaking into your office, being stupid enough to answer my cell phone while in the process of committing a felony, rearming the alarm system on my way out, and then calmly using the ladies' room before I run off with nothing to show for it? Is that the story here?"
Sexton blinked wide-eyed.
"There's a reason people shouldn't drink alone," Gabrielle said. "Now, do you want to talk about NASA or not?"
Sexton felt befuddled as he walked back into his office. He went straight to his wet bar and poured himself a Pepsi. He sure as hell didn't feel drunk. Could he really have been wrong about this? Across the room, his Jourdain ticked mockingly. Sexton drained his Pepsi and poured himself another, and one for Gabrielle.
"Drink, Gabrielle?"
he asked, turning back into the room. Gabrielle hadn't followed him in. She was still standing in the doorway, rubbing his nose in it.
"Oh, for God's sake, come in. Tell me what you found out at NASA."
"I think I've had enough for tonight," she said, sounding distant. "Let's talk tomorrow."
Sexton was in no mood for games. He needed this information now, and he had no intention of begging for it. He heaved a tired sigh.
"Extend the bond of trust. It's all about trust." "I screwed up," he said. "I'm sorry. It's been a hell of a day. I don't know what I was thinking."
Gabrielle remained in the doorway. Sexton walked to his desk and set Gabrielle's Pepsi down on his blotter. He motioned to his leather chair, the position of power.
"Have a seat. Enjoy a soda. I'm going to go stick my head in the sink."
He headed for the bathroom.
Gabrielle still wasn't moving.
I think I saw a fax in the machine, Sexton called over his shoulder as he entered the bathroom.
Show her you trust her.
Have a look at it for me, will you?
Sexton closed the door and filled the sink with cold water. He splashed it on his face and felt no clearer. This had never happened to him before, being so sure and being so wrong. Sexton was a man who trusted his instincts, and his instincts told him Gabrielle Ashe had been in his office. But how? It was impossible. Sexton told himself to forget about it and focus on the matter at hand. NASA. He needed Gabrielle right now. This was no time to alienate her. He needed to know what she knew. Forget your instincts. You were wrong. As Sexton dried his face, he threw his head back and took a deep breath. Relax, he told himself. Don't get punchy. He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply again, feeling better. When Sexton exited the bathroom, he was relieved to see Gabrielle had acquiesced and come back into his office. Good, he thought. Now we can get to business. Gabrielle was standing at his fax machine, flipping through whatever pages had come in. Sexton was confused, however, when he saw her face. It was a mask of disorientation and fear. What is it? Sexton said, moving toward her. Gabrielle teetered as if she were about to pass out. What? The meteorite. She choked, her voice frail as her trembling hand held the stack of fax papers out to him. And your daughter. She's in danger. Bewildered, Sexton walked over and took the fax pages from Gabrielle. The top sheet was a handwritten note. Sexton immediately recognized the writing. The communique was awkward and shocking in its simplicity. Meteorite is fake. Here's proof. NASA, White House trying to kill me. Help. R.S. The senator seldom felt totally at a loss of understanding, but as he reread Rachel's words, he had no idea what to make of them. The meteorite is a fake? NASA and the White House are trying to kill her? In a deepening haze, Sexton began sifting through the half-dozen sheets. The first page was a computerized image whose heading read, Ground Penetrating Radar, GPR. The picture appeared to be an ice sounding of some sort. Sexton saw the extraction pit they had talked about on television. His eye was drawn to what looked like the faint outline of a body floating in the shaft. Then he saw something even more shocking. The clear outline of a second shaft directly beneath where the meteorite had been, as if the stone had been inserted from underneath the ice. What in the world? Flipping to the next page, Sexton came face to face with a photograph of some sort of living ocean species called a Bathynomus giganteus. He stared in utter amazement. That's the animal from the meteorite fossils. Flipping faster now, he saw a graphic display depicting the ionized hydrogen content in the meteorite's crust. This page had a handwritten scrawl on it. Slush hydrogen burn? NASA expander cycle engine? Sexton couldn't believe his eyes. With the room starting to spin around him, he flipped to the final page. A photo of a rock containing metallic bubbles that looked exactly like those in the meteorite. Shockingly, the accompanying description said the rock was the product of oceanic volcanism. A rock from the ocean? Sexton wondered. But NASA said chondrules form only in space. Sexton set the sheets down on his desk and collapsed in his chair. It had taken him only 15 seconds to piece together everything he was looking at. The implications of the images on the papers were crystal clear. Anyone with half a brain could see what these photos proved. The NASA meteorite is a fake. No day in Sexton's career had been filled with such extreme highs and lows. Today had been a rollercoaster ride of hope and despair. Sexton's bafflement over how this enormous scam could possibly have been pulled off evaporated into irrelevance when he realized what the scam meant for him politically.
When I go public with this information, the presidency is mine.
In his upwelling of celebration, Senator Sedgwick Sexton had momentarily forgotten his daughter's claim that she was in trouble.
"Rachel is in danger," Gabrielle said. "Her note says NASA and the White House are trying to..."
Sexton's fax machine suddenly began ringing again. Gabrielle wheeled and stared at the machine. Sexton found himself staring, too. He couldn't imagine what else Rachel could be sending him. More proof? How much more could there be? This is plenty. When the fax machine answered the call, however, no pages came through. The machine, detecting no data signal, had switched to its answering machine feature.
"Hello," Sexton's outbound message crackled. "This is the office of Senator Sedgwick Sexton. If you are trying to send a fax, you may transmit at any time. If not, you may leave a message at the tone."
Before Sexton could pick up, the machine beeped.
"Senator Sexton."
The man's voice had a lucid rawness to it.
"This is William Pickering, Director of the National Reconnaissance Office. You're probably not in the office at this hour, but I need to speak immediately."
He paused as if waiting for someone to pick up. Gabrielle reached to pick up the receiver. Sexton grabbed her hand and violently yanked it away. Gabrielle looked stunned.
"But that's the director of..."
"Senator," Pickering continued, sounding almost relieved that no one had picked up.
"I'm afraid I am calling with some very troubling news. I've just received word that your daughter Rachel is in extreme danger. I have a team trying to help her as we speak. I cannot talk in detail about the situation on the phone, but I was just informed that she may have faxed you some data relating to the NASA meteorite. I haven't seen the data, nor do I know what it is. But the people threatening your daughter have just warned me that if you or anyone goes public with the information, your daughter will die."
"I'm sorry to be so blunt, sir. I do it for clarity's sake. Your daughter's life is being threatened. If she has indeed faxed you something, do not share it with anyone. Not yet. Your daughter's life depends on it. Stay where you are. I will be there shortly."
He paused.
"With luck, Senator, all of this will be resolved by the time you wake up. If, by chance, you get this message before I arrive at your office, stay where you are and call no one. I am doing everything in my power to get your daughter back safely."
Pickering hung up. Gabrielle was trembling.
"Rachel is a hostage?"
Sexton sensed that even in her disillusionment with him, Gabrielle felt a pained empathy to think of a bright young woman in danger. Oddly, Sexton was having trouble mustering the same emotions. Most of him felt like a child who had just been given his most wanted Christmas present, and he refused to let anyone yank it out of his hands.
"Pickering wants me to be quiet about this?"
He stood a moment, trying to decide what all of this meant. In a cold, calculating side of his mind, Sexton felt the machinery beginning to turn. A political computer, playing out every scenario and evaluating each outcome. He glanced at the stack of faxes in his hands and began to sense the raw power of the images. This NASA meteorite had shattered his dream of the presidency. But it was all a lie. A construct. Now those who did this would pay. The meteorite that his enemies had created to destroy him would now make him powerful beyond anyone's wildest imagination. His daughter had seen to that. There is only one acceptable outcome, he knew. Only one course of action for a true leader to take. Feeling hypnotized by the shining images of his own resurrection, Sexton was drifting through a fog as he crossed the room. He went to his copy machine and turned it on, preparing to copy the papers Rachel had faxed him.
"What are you doing?"
Gabrielle demanded, sounding bewildered.
"They won't kill Rachel," Sexton declared. Even if something went wrong, Sexton knew losing his daughter to the enemy would only make him more powerful still. Either way, he would win. Acceptable risk.
"Who are those copies for?" Gabrielle demanded.
William Pickering said not to tell anyone.
Sexton turned from the machine and looked at Gabrielle, amazed by how unattractive he suddenly found her. In that instant, Senator Sexton was an island, untouchable. Everything he needed to accomplish his dreams was now in his hands. Nothing could stop him now. Not claims of bribery, not rumors of sex. Nothing.
Go home, Gabrielle. I have no more use for you.
Chapter 125. It's over, Rachel thought. She and Tolan sat side by side on the deck, staring up into the barrel of the Delta soldier's machine gun. Unfortunately, Pickering now knew where Rachel had sent the fax, the office of Senator Sedgwick Sexton. Rachel doubted her father would ever receive the phone message Pickering had just left him. Pickering could probably get to Sexton's office well before anyone else this morning. If Pickering could get in, quietly remove the fax, and delete the phone message before Sexton arrived, there would be no need to harm the senator. William Pickering was probably one of the few people in Washington who could finagle entry to a U.S. senator's office with no fanfare. Rachel was always amazed at what could be accomplished in the name of national security. Of course, if that fails, Rachel thought, Pickering could just fly by and send a Hellfire missile through the window and blow up the fax machine. Something told her this would not be necessary. Sitting close to Tolan now, Rachel was surprised to feel his hand gently slip into hers. His touch had a tender strength, and their fingers intertwined so naturally that Rachel felt like they'd done this for a lifetime. All she wanted right now was to lie in his arms, sheltered from the oppressive roar of the night sea spiraling around them. Never, she realized, it was not to be. Michael Tolan felt like a man who had found hope on the way to the gallows. Life is mocking me. For years since Celia's death, Tolan had endured nights when he wanted to die, hours of pain and loneliness that seemed only escapable by ending it all. And yet he had chosen life, telling himself he could make it alone. Today, for the first time, Tolan had begun to understand what his friends had been telling him all along. Mike, you don't have to make it alone. You'll find another love. Rachel's hand in his made this irony that much harder to swallow. Fate had cruel timing. He felt as if layers of armor were crumbling away from his heart. For an instant, on the tired decks of the Goya, Tolan sensed Celia's ghost looking over him, as she often did. Her voice was in the rushing water, speaking the last words she'd spoken to him in life. "You're a survivor," her voice whispered. "Promise me you'll find another love." "I'll never want another," Tolan had told her. Celia's smile was filled with wisdom. "You'll have to learn." Now, on the deck of the Goya, Tolan realized he was learning. A deep emotion welled suddenly in his soul. He realized it was happiness, and with it came an overpowering will to live. Pickering felt oddly detached as he moved toward the two prisoners. He stopped in front of Rachel, vaguely surprised that this was not harder for him. "Sometimes," he said, "circumstances raise impossible decisions." Rachel's eyes were unyielding. "You created these circumstances." "War involves casualties," Pickering said, his voice firmer now. "Ask Diana Pickering, or any of those who die every year defending this nation." "You of all people should understand that, Rachel." His eyes focused in on her. "Iacturo pacurum, sawa multus." He could see she recognized the words. Almost a cliché in national security circles. Sacrifice the few to save the many. Rachel eyed him with obvious disgust. "And now, Michael and I have become part of your few?" Pickering considered it. There was no other way. He turned to Delta One. Release your partner and end this. Delta One nodded. Pickering took a long last look at Rachel and then strode to the ship's nearby portside railing, staring out at the sea racing by. This was something he preferred not to watch. Delta One felt empowered as he gripped his weapon and glanced over at his partner, dangling in the clamps. All that remained was to close the trap doors beneath Delta Two's feet, free him from the clamps, and eliminate Rachel Sexton and Michael Tolland. Unfortunately, Delta One had seen the complexity of the control panel near the trap door, a series of unmarked levers and dials that apparently controlled the trap door, the winch motor, and numerous other commands. He had no intention of hitting the wrong lever and risking his partner's life by mistakenly dropping the sub into the sea. Eliminate all risk. Never rush. He would force Tolland to perform the actual release. To ensure that he didn't try anything tricky, Delta One would take out insurance known in his business as biological collateral. Use your adversaries against one another. Delta One swung the gun barrel directly into Rachel's face, stopping only inches from her forehead. Rachel closed her eyes, and Delta One could see Tolland's fists clench in a protective anger. "Miss Sexton, stand up," Delta One said. She did. With the gun firmly on her back, Delta One marched her over to an aluminum set of portable stairs that led up to the top of the Triton sub from behind. "Climb up and stand on top of the sub." Rachel looked frightened and confused. "Just do it," Delta One said. Rachel felt like she was moving through a nightmare as she climbed up the aluminum gangway behind the Triton. She stopped at the top, having no desire to step out over the chasm onto the suspended Triton. "Get on top of the sub," the soldier said, returning to Tolland and pushing the gun against his head. In front of Rachel, the soldier who was in the clamps watched her, shifting in pain, obviously eager to get out. Rachel looked at Tolland, who now had a gun barrel to his head. "Get on top of the sub." She had no choice. Feeling like she was edging out onto a precipice overhanging a canyon, Rachel stepped onto the Triton's engine casing, a small flat section behind the rounded dome window. The entire sub hung like a massive plumb bob over the open trapdoor. Even suspended on its winch cable, the 9-ton sub barely registered her arrival, swinging only a few millimeters as she steadied herself. "Okay, let's move," the soldier said to Tolland. "Go to the controls and close the trapdoor." At gunpoint, Tolland began moving toward the control panel with the soldier behind him. As Tolland came toward her, he was moving slowly, and Rachel could feel his eyes fixing hard on her as if trying to send her a message. He looked directly at her and then down at the open hatch on top of the Triton. Rachel glanced down. The hatch at her feet was open. The heavy circular covering propped open. She could see down into the one-seater cockpit. "He wants me to get in?" Sensing she must be mistaken, Rachel looked at Tolland again. He was almost to the control panel. Tolland's eyes locked on her. This time he was less subtle. His lips mouthed, "Jump in. Now." Delta One saw Rachel's motion out of the corner of his eye and wheeled on instinct, opening fire as Rachel fell through the sub's hatch just below the barrage of bullets. The open hatch covering rang out as the bullets ricocheted off the circular portal, sending up a shower of sparks and slamming the lid closed on top of her. Tolland, the instant he'd felt the gun leave his back, made his move. He dove to his left, away from the trap door, hitting the deck and rolling just as the soldier spun back toward him, gun blazing. Bullets exploded behind Tolland as he scrambled for cover behind the ship's stern anchor spool, an enormous motorized cylinder, around which was wound several thousand feet of steel cable connected to the ship's anchor. Tolland had a plan and would have to act fast. As the soldier dashed toward him, Tolland reached up and grabbed the anchor lock with both hands, yanking down. Instantly the anchor spool began feeding out lengths of cable, and the Goyle lurched in the strong current. The sudden movement sent everything and everyone on the deck staggering sidelong. As the boat accelerated in reverse on the current, the anchor spool doled out cable faster and faster.
"Come on, baby," Tolland urged.
The soldier regained his balance and came for Tolland. Waiting until the last possible moment, Tolland braced himself and rammed the lever back up, locking the anchor spool. The chain snapped taut, stopping the ship short and sending a tremulous shudder throughout the Goya. Everything on deck went flying. The soldier staggered to his knees near Tolland. Pickering fell back from the railing onto the deck. The Triton swung wildly on its cable. A grating howl of failing metal tore up from beneath the ship like an earthquake as the damaged strut finally gave way. The right stern corner of the Goya began collapsing under its own weight. The ship faltered, tilting on a diagonal like a massive table, losing one of its four legs. The noise from beneath was deafening, a wail of twisting, grating metal and pounding surf. White-knuckled inside the Triton cockpit, Rachel held on as the 9-ton machine swayed over the trap door in the now steeply inclined deck. Through the base of the glass dome, she could see the ocean raging below. As she looked up, her eyes scanning the deck for Tolland, she watched a bizarre drama on the deck unfold in a matter of seconds. Only a yard away, trapped in the Triton's claws, the clamped Delta soldier was howling in pain as he bobbed like a puppet on a stick. William Pickering scrambled across Rachel's field of vision and grabbed onto a cleat on the deck. Near the anchor lever, Tolland was also hanging on, trying not to slide over the edge into the water. When Rachel saw the soldier with the machine gun stabilizing himself nearby, she called out inside the sub, "Mike, look out!" But Delta One ignored Tolland entirely. The soldier was looking back toward the idling helicopter with his mouth open in horror. Rachel turned, following his gaze. The Kiowa gunship, with its huge rotors still turning, had started to slowly slide forward down the tipping deck. Its long metal skids were acting like skis on a slope. It was then that Rachel realized the huge machine was skidding directly toward the Triton. Scrambling up the inclined deck toward the sliding aircraft, Delta One clambered into the cockpit. He had no intention of letting their only means of escape slide off the deck. Delta One seized the Kiowa's controls and heaved back on the stick. "Lift off!" With a deafening roar, the blades accelerated overhead, straining to lift the heavily armed gunship off the deck. "Up! God damn it!" The chopper was sliding directly toward the Triton, and Delta Two suspended in its grasp. With its nose tipped forward, the Kiowa's blades were also tipped, and when the chopper lurched off the deck, it sailed more forward than up, accelerating toward the Triton like a giant buzzsaw. "Up!" Delta One pulled the stick, wishing he could drop the half-ton of Hellfire warheads weighing him down. The blades just missed the top of Delta Two's head and the top of the Triton sub. But the chopper was moving too fast. It would never clear the Triton's winch cable. As the Kiowa's 300 RPM steel blades collided with the sub's 15-ton capacity braided steel winch cable, the night erupted with the shriek of metal on metal. The sounds conjured images of epic battle. From the chopper's armored cockpit, Delta One watched his rotors tear into the sub's cable like a giant lawnmower running over a steel chain. A blinding spray of sparks erupted overhead, and the Kiowa's blades exploded. Delta One felt the chopper bottom out, its struts hitting the deck hard. He tried to control the aircraft, but he had no lift. The chopper bounded twice down the inclined deck, then slid, crashing into the ship's guardrail. For a moment he thought the rail would hold. Then Delta One heard the crack. The heavily laden chopper listed over the brink, plummeting into the sea. Inside the Triton, Rachel Sexton sat paralyzed, her body pressed back into the sub-seat. The mini-sub had been tossed violently as the chopper's rotor wrapped around the cable, but she had managed to hang on. Somehow the blades had missed the main body of the sub, but she knew there had to be major damage to the cable. All Rachel could think of at that point was escaping from the sub as fast as she could. The soldier trapped in the clamps stared in at her, delirious, bleeding, and burned from the shrapnel. Beyond him, Rachel saw William Pickering still holding on to a cleat on the slanting deck.
"Where's Michael?" She didn't see him.
Her panic lasted only an instant as a new fear descended. Overhead, the Triton's shredded winch cable let out an ominous whipping noise as the braids unraveled. Then there was a loud snap, and Rachel felt the cable give way. Momentarily weightless, Rachel hovered above her seat inside the cockpit as the sub hurtled downward. The deck disappeared overhead, and the catwalks under the Goya raced by. The soldier trapped in the claws went white with fear, staring at Rachel as the sub accelerated downward. The fall seemed endless. When the sub crashed into the sea beneath the Goya, it plunged hard under the surf, ramming Rachel down hard into her seat. Her spine compressed as the illuminated ocean raced up over the dome. She felt a suffocating drag as the sub slowed to a stop underwater and then raced back toward the surface, bobbing up like a cork. The sharks hit it instantly. From her front row seat, Rachel sat frozen in place as the spectacle unfolded only a few feet away. Delta II felt the shark's oblong head crash into him with unimaginable force. A razor-sharp clamp tightened on his upper arm, slicing to the bone and locking on. A flash of white-hot pain exploded as the shark torqued its powerful body and shook its head violently, tearing Delta II's arm off his body. Other sharks moved in, knives stabbing at his legs, torso, neck. Delta II had no breath to scream in agony as the sharks ripped huge chunks of his body away. The last thing he saw was a crescent-shaped mouth tilting sideways, a gorge of teeth clamping down across his face. The world went black. Inside the Triton, the thudding of heavy cartilaginous heads ramming into the dome finally subsided. Rachel opened her eyes. The man was gone. The water washing against the window was crimson. Badly battered, Rachel huddled in her chair, knees pulled to her chest. She could feel the sub moving. It was drifting on the current, scraping along the length of the Goya's lower dive deck. She could feel it moving in another direction as well. Down. Outside, the distinctive gurgling of water into the ballast tanks grew louder. The ocean inched higher on the glass in front of her.
"I'm sinking."
A jolt of terror shot through Rachel, and she was suddenly scrambling to her feet. Reaching overhead, she grabbed the hatch mechanism. If she could climb up on top of the sub, she still had time to jump onto the Goya's dive deck. It was only a few feet away.
"I've got to get out."
The hatch mechanism was clearly marked which way to turn it to open. She heaved. The hatch didn't budge. She tried again. Nothing. The portal was jammed shut, bent. As the fear rose in her blood like the sea around her, Rachel heaved one last time. The hatch did not move. The Triton sank a few inches deeper, bumping the Goya one last time before drifting out from underneath the mangled hull and into the open sea. Chapter 126.
"Don't do this,"
Gabrielle begged the senator as he finished at the copy machine.
"You're risking your daughter's life."
Sexton blocked out her voice, moving back to his desk now with 10 identical stacks of photocopies. Each stack contained copies of the pages Rachel had faxed him, including her handwritten note claiming the meteorite was a fake and accusing NASA and the White House of trying to kill her. "The most shocking media kits ever assembled," Sexton thought, as he began carefully inserting each stack into its own large white linen envelope. Each envelope bore his name, office address, and senatorial seal. There would be no doubt where this incredible information had originated. The political scandal of the century, Sexton thought, and I will be the one to reveal it. Gabrielle was still pleading for Rachel's safety, but Sexton heard only silence. As he assembled the envelopes, he was in his own private world. Every political career has a defining moment. This is mine. William Pickering's phone message had warned that if Sexton went public, Rachel's life would be in danger. Unfortunately for Rachel, Sexton also knew if he went public with proof of NASA's fraud, that single act of boldness would land him in the White House with more decisiveness and political drama than ever before witnessed in American politics. Life is filled with difficult decisions, he thought, and winners are those who make them. Gabrielle Ashe had seen this look in Sexton's eyes before. Blind ambition. She feared it, and with good reason, she now realized. Sexton was obviously prepared to risk his daughter in order to be the first to announce the NASA fraud.
"Don't you see you've already won?" Gabrielle demanded. "There's no way Zach Herney and NASA will survive this scandal, no matter who makes it public, no matter when it comes out. Wait until you know Rachel is safe. Wait until you talk to Pickering."
Sexton was clearly no longer listening to her. Opening his desk drawer, he pulled out a foil sheet on which were affixed dozens of nickel-sized, self-adhesive wax seals with his initials on them. Gabrielle knew he usually used these for formal invitations, but he apparently thought a crimson wax seal would give each envelope an extra touch of drama. Peeling the circular seals off the foil, Sexton pressed one onto the pleat of each envelope, sealing it like a monogrammed epistle. Gabrielle's heart pulsed now with a new anger. She thought of the digitized images of illegal checks in his computer. If she said anything, she knew he would just delete the evidence.
"Don't do this," she said, "or I'll go public about our affair."
Sexton laughed out loud as he affixed the wax seals.
"Really? And you think they'll believe you? A power-hungry aide denied a post in my administration and looking for revenge at any cost? I denied our involvement once, and the world believed me. I'll simply deny it again."
"The White House has photos," Gabrielle declared. Sexton didn't even look up.
"They don't have photos. And even if they did, they're meaningless."
He affixed the final wax seal.
"I have immunity. These envelopes out-trump anything anyone could possibly throw at me."
Gabrielle knew he was right. She felt utterly helpless as Sexton admired his handiwork. On his desk sat 10 elegant white linen envelopes, each embossed with his name and address, and secured with a crimson wax seal bearing his scripted initials. They looked like royal letters. Certainly kings had been crowned on account of less potent information. Sexton picked up the envelopes and prepared to leave. Gabrielle stepped over and blocked his way.
"You're making a mistake. This can wait."
Sexton's eyes bored into her.
"I made you, Gabrielle, and now I've unmade you."
"That fax from Rachel will give you the presidency. You owe her."
"I've given her plenty."
"What if something happens to her?"
"Then she'll cement my sympathy vote."
Gabrielle couldn't believe the thought had even crossed his mind, much less his lips. Disgusted, she reached for the phone.
"I'm calling the White..."
Sexton spun and slapped her hard across the face. Gabrielle staggered back, feeling her lips split open. She caught herself grabbing onto the desk, staring up in astonishment at the man she had once worshipped. Sexton gave her a long, hard look.
"If you so much as think of crossing me on this, I will make you regret it for the rest of your life."
He stood unflinching, clutching the stack of sealed envelopes under his arm. A harsh danger burned in his eyes. When Gabrielle exited the office building into the cold night air, her lip was still bleeding. She hailed a taxi and climbed in. Then, for the first time since she had come to Washington, Gabrielle Ash broke down and cried. Chapter 127. The Triton fell. Michael Tollins staggered to his feet on the inclined deck and peered over the anchor spool at the frayed winch cable where the Triton used to hang. Wheeling toward the stern, he scanned the water. The Triton was just now emerging from under the Goya on the current. Relieved at least to see the sub intact, Tollins eyed the hatch, wanting nothing more than to see it open up and Rachel climb out unscathed. But the hatch remained closed. Tollins wondered if maybe she had been knocked out by the violent fall. Even from the deck, Tollins could see the Triton was riding exceptionally low in the water, far below its normal diving trim waterline. It's sinking. Tollins couldn't imagine why, but the reason at the moment was immaterial. I have to get Rachel out, now. As Tollins stood to dash for the edge of the deck, a shower of machine gun fire exploded above him, sparking off the heavy anchor spool overhead. He dropped back to his knees. Shit! He peered around the spool only long enough to see Pickering on the upper deck, taking aim like a sniper. The Delta soldier had dropped his machine gun while climbing into the doomed helicopter, and Pickering had apparently recovered it. Now the director had scrambled to the high ground. Trapped behind the spool, Tollins looked back toward the sinking Triton. Come on, Rachel! Get out! He waited for the hatch to open. Nothing. Looking back to the deck of the Goya, Tollins' eyes measured the open area between his position and the stern railing. 20 feet. A long way without any cover. Tollins took a deep breath and made up his mind. Ripping off his shirt, he hurled it to his right onto the open deck. While Pickering blew the shirt full of holes, Tollins dashed left down the inclined deck, banking toward the stern. With a wild leap, he launched himself over the railing off the back of the ship. Arcing high in the air, Tollins heard the bullets whizzing all around him and knew a single graze would make him a shark feast the instant he hit the water. Rachel Sexton felt like a wild animal trapped in a cage. She had tried the hatch again and again with no luck. She could hear a tank somewhere beneath her filling with water, and she sensed the sub gaining weight. The darkness of the ocean was inching higher up the transparent dome, a black curtain rising in reverse. Through the lower half of the glass, Rachel could see the void of the ocean beckoning like a tomb. The empty vastness beneath threatened to swallow her whole. She grabbed the hatch mechanism and tried to twist it open one more time, but it wouldn't budge. Her lungs strained now, the dank stench of excess carbon dioxide acrid in her nostrils. Through it all, one recurring thought haunted her. I'm going to die alone underwater. She scanned the Triton's control panels and levers for something that could help, but all the indicators were black. No power. She was locked in a dead steel crypt, sinking toward the bottom of the sea. The gurgling in the tanks seemed to be accelerating now, and the ocean rose to within a few feet of the top of the glass. In the distance, across the endless flat expanse, a band of crimson was inching across the horizon. Morning was on its way. Rachel feared it would be the last light she ever saw. Closing her eyes to block out her impending fate, Rachel felt the terrifying childhood images rushing into her mind. Falling through the ice, sliding underwater, breathless, unable to lift herself, sinking. Her mother calling for her, Rachel! Rachel! A pounding on the outside of the sub jolted Rachel out of the delirium. Her eyes snapped open. Rachel! The voice was muffled. A ghostly face appeared against the glass, upside down, dark hair swirling. She could barely make him out in the darkness. Michael! Tollins surfaced, exhaling in relief to see Rachel moving inside the sub. She's alive! Tollins swam with powerful strokes to the rear of the Triton and climbed up onto the submerged engine platform. The ocean currents felt hot and leaden around him as he positioned himself to grab the circular portal screw, staying low and hoping he